Allison Davis Blake joined the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan in July 2011 as the esteemed business school's first female dean. She is the Edward J. Fry Dean and Stephen M. Ross Professor of Business. Dean Davis Blake is an expert on outsourcing, the use of temporary and contract workers, and the effective management of organizational hiring, salary, and promotion systems. She earned a PhD in organizational behavior from Stanford University and has held prestigious editorial positions with the Administrative Science Quarterly, Academy of Management Review, and the Journal of Management. Professor Davis Blake has taught courses in organizational behavior, fundamentals of management, strategic human resource management, and managing human capital. She also recently completed a 3-year term as a board member of the Association to Advance Collegiate Schools of Business, the premier accrediting body for business schools worldwide. Dean Davis Blake is an alumna of Brigham Young University, graduating summa cum laude with a BS in economics and subsequently a master's in organizational behavior. She's married, and she and her husband have 2 children. Would you please join me in giving a warm welcome to Dean Allison Davis Blake?
Thank you very much for that warm welcome. I will say it's absolutely amazing to stand at this podium. When I sat out in that audience I've got to confess, the late 1970s, I never imagined being here. But here I am, and hopefully what I have to say today will be worthwhile to you. Let me just begin by taking us back a second. During the past several years, the business world has been rocked by scandals. I don't need to tell you that names like Enron, Arthur Andersen, Tyco, WorldCom, and Barclays have become synonymous with what some perceive as a broken moral compass in the world of business. In preparation for these remarks, I Googled corporate scandals, and the first item that came up was a list of 80 what I call major scandals from the last decade. During all of this time of scandal, I've been a professor and leader in various business schools around the country. And one trend that I've seen is that students increasingly say to me, I don't want to be like those business people I see in the news. They're greedy. They're selfish. They're harmful to individuals, communities, and sometimes even the natural environment. I want to do good in the world. So after my bachelor's or master's degree in business, I'm going to work in a nonprofit, in government, or in an NGO because I want to work someplace where I can make a positive difference in the world. My response to these statements is that nonprofits and NGOs are not the only place where you can do good. You can work in and lead a highly profitable business and do good. And indeed, today, there's a new social movement comprised of people who want to use and do use the immense power of business to make a positive difference in the world. This social movement, like most early-stage social movements, is quite loosely organized and goes by many names: conscious capitalism, creative capitalism, shared value creation, and positive business are just a few of those. At the University of Michigan and the Ross School of Business, we've been on the forefront of studying positive business. And based on our research and our interactions with countless people who practice positive business, I want to share with you today how you can lead in the world of business and make a positive difference in the world. Some of you may be here saying, but I'm not planning a career in business, and although my ideas will be kind of tilted toward the world of business, I think that they'll apply to you as leaders, whatever career and whatever field you decide to pursue. Now, throughout my remarks today, I'm going to be using the word leadership a lot. Many people have 2 misconceptions about leadership that I think we need to erase before we get started. First, many people believe that in order to be a leader, you need a title or a position that identifies you as a leader. However, if we just think about it at its core, leadership is basically nothing more than the ability to influence others to take particular actions or to achieve specific goals. In order to have that kind of influence, you need no formal title. Rather, you need to have a set of attributes and abilities that I'll talk about. So the first misconception about leadership is you need a title, but you really don't. A second misconception about leadership is that some people are just born to be leaders. They're born with attributes and abilities, maybe genetically programmed for leadership, and they're the ones who can be leaders. You know, there have been decades, literally decades of research that have tried to find specific heritable personality traits that all leaders have. And this research has not proved very fruitful. I still remember my first semester at Stanford University as a PhD student. I took a graduate level introduction to social psychology with the eminent social psychologists Lee Ross and Mark Lepper. And Lee led a class on leadership, which I can still recall to this day. Lee got up in front of the class and said, "Well, for 50 years, we've been trying to find out what personality traits or attributes leaders share. And I can tell you today, we know one thing. Leaders are tall." And he looked at us like, "All right, we're done with that. We're going on to something else now. Leaders are tall." I still remember it. So why has his research not found one set of heritable personality traits? Because, as I said, leadership is a set of skills and attributes that any of you can develop. And my personal belief is, if you want to know if you're a leader, don't look in the mirror. Look in the eyes of the people you lead. Then you'll know if you're a leader. The theme of my remarks will be centered around the topics of positive leadership and positive business, both of which are very important trends in my field of expertise, which is organizational behavior, and also topics with which I have extensive personal experience. And today, I want to talk with you about how you can become a leader who does three things. First, a leader who has a positive impact on others, one by one. Second, a leader who creates organizations where individuals are thriving, innovative, and bringing their best selves to work every day. And third, a leader who uses the enormous power of business to make a positive difference in the world. I'll illustrate how you can do these things with examples from my own experiences as a leader. Given where you are, most of you are in your careers, I'm going to spend the most time on having a positive impact on others one by one, because you can do that right now, and a little less time on creating thriving organizations and using the power of business for good. So let's consider these three topics and these three aspects of positive leadership in order. First, how do you become a leader who has a positive impact on others one by one? There are lots of frameworks for thinking about this that you might learn in class. And I'm going to, since I'm at the University of Michigan, talk about one that's been developed at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business, where our faculty have been thinking about this question for many years, and they've developed a very useful conceptual framework that we implement in our academic programs. The Michigan model of leadership identifies four attributes of leaders who have a positive impact on others. Now, as I'm talking, you may find that you already have some of these attributes, but if you don't, you most certainly can develop them, and that's what I want you to remember. Even if it doesn't sound like you, you can become this. Even if you do have these attributes, you can work to enhance them. So the four attributes that the Michigan model of leadership highlights are empathy, courage, integrity, and drive. Let's talk about each of these in turn. First, let's talk about empathy, which I think is at the core of leadership. As I mentioned earlier, leadership is definitely not about you. It's about the people you lead. To be an effective leader, you first must understand the people you lead. What are their interests? What are their concerns? What are their motives? And given their interests, concerns, and motives, how can you work with them? Not direct them, not order them. How can you work with them to help them be their very best selves in the service of the goals of the organization? Empathy starts with a very simple principle that I think is best illustrated by a story. The Ross School of Business has a beautiful new LEED certified building, and I receive, as dean, lots of compliments on the building's architecture and maintenance. Most of the public areas have cork floors, and when I arrived at Michigan, I noticed that these floors were very prone to scuff marks. These marks actually reminded me of the ones that my boys made when they were little boys, running through our wood floors in their good shoes after church. Long and black and hard to get up. But these floors, these cork floors, which you could see got those marks during the day, always look good, especially first thing in the morning. And one morning, I was coming in very early, before 6 in the morning, to complete an important project. The building was very quiet. But as I walked up the stairs, I noticed a lone member of our janitorial staff using a rather unwieldy machine to buff away all those scuff marks. And I thought, oh, that's how it's done. But when I got to the top of the stairs, this janitor was a ways away from me, maybe about where the third or fourth row of the seating is there. And for some reason, I stopped and I watched the work he was doing. And what first made me stop is I was curious, how does he get these things off and does he have any tricks I can use? But as I watched him, I saw him, and for some reason, I really saw him in a new way, because I started asking myself, I wonder what it feels like to buff all these scuff marks off the floors every morning all by yourself. I could see that it might feel a bit lonely, repetitive, and thankless, and you might wonder, does anyone notice that I'm here doing this? Now, I tell you, having my mind attuned to those scuff marks, living in an all-male household and being the ones who takes them off, I noticed his work. So I decided to tell him that I definitely noticed him. I walked up to him, introduced myself, asked him his name, which happened to be Jose, and I told him that I noticed how clean the floors were and that I got many compliments on the cleanliness of our building, but that those compliments did not belong to me. They belonged to him. He said thank you, and we parted. A few weeks later, I came in again very early. I saw Jose at work, and this time he came up to me, greeted me, and he told me, I've been working really hard to keep the floors clean for you, which kind of took me aback a little bit because I wasn't giving him any kind of command. I was just recognizing his work. But I just again told him what great work he was doing, and I assured him that not only I, but everyone who used the building noticed his work. I've had many experiences like this over the years, and they all point to one single principle. Most people want to do a good job at work. And as a leader, what you must do is see the good that people do and want to do, and then let them know that you see it. The more you do this, the more good people will want to do at work, and the more they'll do a great job. Seeing the good sometimes takes just a little bit of time, but it has a large effect. So if you don't remember anything else from today, remember this. Whoever you are, wherever you are in an organization, if you want to have a positive impact on others, it starts by seeing the good, because it's there. John Quincy Adams, the sixth president of the United States, is said to have made a statement about leadership that helps me remember to see the good. Both of my boys happen to be Eagle Scouts, and at their Eagle Scout Court of Honor, my husband, who doesn't like public speaking, said, well, you'll just have to do the family talk. So my son, as I had the, I don't know what it was, they had to listen to me talk about leadership. And to both of them, I asked them to remember this quote attributed to John Quincy Adams. Quote, if your actions inspire others to dream more, learn more, do more, and become more, then you are a leader. To inspire others to act in the way that Adams talks about, you first must see the good that they do so that you can inspire them to act. So that's empathy. See people, really see people, and see the good. The second attribute of leaders who have a positive influence on others is courage. One thing I can tell you I did not appreciate at all about leadership when I became a leader, but I now see with great clarity, is that leadership is about a lot of mundane actions whose effects aren't necessarily obvious in the moment, like talking with Jose about cleaning the floors, punctuated by moments where it's very clear that you can make a real difference. In my experience, those moments where you can make a real difference require courage. They require you to do something that many people see needs to be done, but that no one else is willing to do, or in some cases, that no one else can do. I first learned this lesson about the need for courage as a leader some years ago when I was a new leader, and I still look back on this experience I'm about to tell you as the very best day of work I've ever done, bar none. So one day, I'm brand new, I've got a lot of staff reporting to me. I don't know who most of them are. And I'm coming back from lunch, and a staff member came into my office quite distraught and said, "Oh, some people from IT security are down the hall. They're seizing someone's computer. You've got to go do something." So I walked down to inquire, and they were there, like some kind of IT stormtroopers. They were tearing the place apart. They were seizing all manner of electronics. The office occupant, who I did not know and had never met, was rumored to be off crying somewhere. I said, "Oh, gentlemen," I introduced myself. "Kind of unusual activity you're engaged in. What's happening?" And they just looked at me and said, "We're here from IT security. You will be called." Okay, you call me. And I was called. I was called later by the head of IT security, and it turned out that the occupant of the office, a young woman, was accused of, and it later turned out to be true, was abusing her authorized access to our IT systems to post confidential university information on the internet, and it was definitely things that were highly sensitive and actually not legal to post. So we put this young woman, I put her on administrative leave, never actually saw her because she left the building, never had met her, and we tried to figure out what to do. It's very clear what the university wanted in this case. We wanted to know precisely all the information this young woman had posted and where. We wanted to address the postings, and of course, the young woman's employment had to end and she needed to move on. It seemed simple. Tell us what you did, leave the university, we're done here. But with apologies to any lawyers in the room, I will say that both sides immediately engaged lawyers, and the situation that seemed so simple to me wasn't simple at all. I sat in on our initial brief conversation, me with our attorney from the university, this young woman who I met for the first time in that meeting with her attorney, and I've got to say, to me, it just looked like the attorneys trading bombastic threats. It was clear the university's strategy was to use threat of prosecution to get this young woman to crack. The young woman's attorney used similar tactics of all he was going to do to expose the great ills of the university to achieve his objectives. And that was kind of getting us nowhere, I thought. And it was a very brief meeting. But during that meeting, I noticed this young woman for the first time sitting beside her attorney, almost trembling, without saying a word. And I thought, she looks afraid. She even looks afraid of her own attorney. And then the meeting was over. As the days wore on, our lead attorney for the university repeatedly warned me, with harsh words and strong language that I definitely could not say from this podium, not to have any contact with this young woman, as it would jeopardize our strategy, which, by the way, was not working. I knew his warnings, however threatening, were to me in my position advisory, not mandatory. That's not how he framed it, but I was aware he actually could not command me. He could only advise me. But I can tell you that those warnings made an impression on me. And I was new, and I thought, well, he knows. He's been around. And I was following his advice. Until one day, this young woman's supervisors came to see me. They had not spoken to her since she left the building by order of our attorneys. But they indicated to me that this young woman was a good person. They knew her. They'd worked with her for 5 years. They knew she'd made a mistake. They felt she would want to make it right. And then they said words that I just found terrible. They said, "You're the only one who can intervene. You're the only one with the authority. Please call her, explain to her that the stalemate is not good for her, and show her how, with her cooperation, we could resolve the situation in a way that was good for her and the university." And I just kind of sat there dumbfounded. Really? You think I can do that? I didn't feel like I could do that. But I trusted these people. I knew them. I trusted their judgment about this young woman. I sat in my office for a long time. They probably came to see me at 5 o'clock. Everything bad happens at the end of the day. Write that down if you're taking notes. Everything bad happens at the end of the day or on a weekend. 5 o'clock, and the clock ticked, and it ticked, and it ticked, and I sat a long time thinking about that young woman's face and those fearful eyes, thinking about her managers. And, of course, the person that I reported to who could have assisted me was in a remote region of Asia on a boat on the Yangtze River and was unavailable. So I had to decide on my own. And I just kept thinking about those eyes. And the clock ticked on at 9 o'clock. I thought, if I'm going to do this, I better do it now. I picked up the phone, and I called this young woman, who was very confused. I just said that I introduced myself. She knew who I was. And I said, I just want to talk about your situation and what you're thinking. She was all over the map. And I remember thinking, you don't need a lawyer. You need a mother. You need someone to kind of get yourself straightened out here. So I just said, all right, I hear all that you're thinking. Let me tell you what the university needs and why, and you tell me what you need and why. She said what she wanted to do was go to graduate school, and she was very fearful of having a termination for cause on her record, and she did say she was fearful of her attorney and was thinking of getting another one, which I endorsed heartily as a course of action. So I said, all right, there is a way for you to get what you want and the university to get what it wants. And I could not believe what was coming out of my mouth next. I said, you come in tomorrow morning with your new attorney, and I'm going to go down with you to the general counsel's office, and I'm going to sit there beside you, because one of her fears, she said, that general counsel, he's a very scary man. I said, yeah, I hear you. He is a very scary man. But I'm going to go sit beside you, and I'm going to ensure that he doesn't do anything that's very scary. We're going to work this out just like you and I talked about. You're going to get what you need, and the university is going to get what we need. Hung up the phone. She committed to be there in the morning with her new attorney, and we were going to walk over together and work it out. But then I had to call our general counsel and tell him what I had done, and I held the phone, out here. When I was doing so, I reached him. He was obviously in a restaurant where I could hear the clinking of glasses, and I told him I've taken a managerial decision, which he knew was my right. I made this call. Here's what's happening. And he said, oh, I'm so glad you worked that out. And I said, we'll be by to see you in the morning. I wanted to ask him, have you been drinking? I mean, all these threats and bombast, are you going to come down to? I'm glad you worked that out. I said, okay, bye. We'll see you in the morning. And the next morning, his demeanor was still very pleasant. The young woman, her new attorney, and I went over to see him, and we did work it out. She gave us the information we needed. She tendered her resignation. The matter was closed. Recently, I heard from this young woman. She was sitting for the bar exam in another state and wanted to use my name as a reference regarding this incident because she had been the subject of university discipline. She told me how much she'd learned from this long ago incident and how even that meeting with the general counsel, who quite graciously impressed upon her that if she was going to be an attorney, that she had to take ethics very seriously, how much she learned from that, and had never had any other dealings with the IT stormtroopers since she left. And she now has, I'm proud to say, a very successful career as an attorney. The best day's work I've ever done, from empathy and courage. And believe me, the story sounds so easy today, but when I picked up that phone at 9 o'clock, I can tell you my hands were shaking. Empathy and courage give you a direction in which to lead. A direction that sees the good in people and that does the right thing in a difficult situation. The third and fourth attributes of a leader are not so much about what you do, but how you do things. The third attribute is integrity. We often think of integrity as doing what's right, and that's true, but there's more to integrity than that. The Latin word for integrity is integritas, from the word integer, meaning complete or whole. In the dictionary, the first meaning of integrity is, quote, adherence to moral and ethical principles, unquote. But the second meaning is, quote, the state of being whole, entire, or undiminished, unquote. In addition to doing the right thing, integrity means that you should act so that your whole set of activities could be made visible to anyone at any time. There are obviously some things, such as personnel decisions, that require confidentiality to protect the privacy of others. However, my advice to you is if you find yourself wanting to keep things secret, not to protect others, but to protect yourself, this is a sign of a lack of integrity. Let me give you a story that illustrates this principle. I once had a role that involved allocating several sums of money out to five other area managers. When I took this role, my predecessor said, "I have one thing to tell you. Don't ever let the area managers know how much money you have." I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because then they'll ask a lot of questions you don't want to answer." I said, "Okay." So I looked at the allocations across the five areas, and I saw instantly why my predecessor gave this advice, because I couldn't see any rational basis for these allocations, and indeed I could see evidence of what seemed like patterns of personal favoritism. But I could also see that making those allocations public would probably be an occasion for bitterness and unresolved conflict. So I pondered that advice for some time and finally concluded, his advice is essentially to hide my activities from the people who report to me, the people with whom I must work closely to accomplish our common objectives. Is hiding information really the best way to facilitate our working relationship? And if I have to hide information, doesn't it imply that I actually have something to hide? So after thinking this through, I decided to do something that, to my knowledge, no one in my position had ever done before. I decided to sit down with the five area managers and show them all the numbers. This is how much money we have. This is how it's been allocated. There were three different budgets, each with a different purpose, to be allocated across the five areas. For regulatory reasons, each of these budgets had to be allocated separately. They could not be combined. So I sat down with the area managers and said, "Here are all the types of resources I allocate to you. There is nothing else. I'm holding nothing back. I will show you the historical allocations, and I want you to work with me to decide on what basis we should make these allocations going forward." I suggested a few ideas, but said these are really just starting points. Then I handed out the numbers that showed how much everyone had been getting from these three budgets. The room was silent, very, very still, and I wasn't so sure I was doing a good thing, because you could almost hear the people formulating their grievances about the past. Then a strange thing happened, something totally unexpected. The manager of the area that had obviously been the most advantaged spoke first. He said something to the effect of, "I can see we've been getting too much." Whoa, that was interesting. And he further said, "We need to do something different, because what we're doing is not fair. I would like the change to happen over time so that we can adjust to it. But I see a change needs to happen." From there, we went on devising allocation formulas that were better, I can tell you, than anything I generated on my own. That took several meetings, but once those were in place, I simply implemented them every year. From this experience, I learned a really important lesson about integrity, that integrity is not just doing what is right. It is having the courage and confidence to let the people, especially close to you, the people close to you, see and participate in what you are doing so that what you are doing is whole and complete, not only in your own eyes, but in the eyes of the people you're leading. So far, I've said that you should use the insights you gain through empathy and courage to act with integrity. The final piece of how you should act as a leader is the one piece that appears first in many books and articles on leadership. I think it is a very important piece of how you do things, but I think that piece should operate in the service of empathy, courage, and integrity, so I place it last. That fourth piece is drive. As a leader, you will be faced, especially as you advance, with many complex and difficult problems. Those problems will require effort to solve, sometimes extraordinary effort. I've found that as I've moved into positions of greater responsibility, the complexity and difficulty of dealing with the problems with which I must grapple has increased exponentially. Now, people sometimes ask me, what's the dean do? It's a hard question for me to answer, but I say, I really do no real work because I don't teach any classes. I'm not actively doing a lot of research like some of my colleagues are. I'm not certainly getting those scuff marks off the floor. All my job is solving problems that are so difficult or so unpleasant that no one else wants to solve them. That's pretty much my job. Now, Some people think that a leader gets traction on these difficult problems simply by being smarter than anyone else. And a word of warning to you, you will never be the smartest person in the room on all dimensions. And if you start to think you're the smartest person in the room, that's a warning sign that you've lost your way. Some people think a leader gets traction on difficult problems by working longer and harder than other people. And there's some truth to that. Difficult problems often do require lots of data analysis, consultation, and effort that is far beyond ordinary. But in my experience, drive is not just working harder than others. It means working in a more flexible and resilient manner. I learned a lot about flexibility and resilience during the fall of 2008, which is, as you know, the start of the current financial crisis that we're working our way out of. I was a relatively new dean then with just over a year of experience. And I remember driving to work in the early mornings that fall and listening with grave concern as the radio news reported investment banks, insurance companies, and auto companies moving towards bankruptcy and the stock market plunging downward. Soon, the university announced it would have to implement mid-year budget cuts to address declining state revenues. Newspaper headlines screamed that those budget cuts would surely mean layoffs at the university. I could literally feel the fear and anxiety growing within our building, especially among employees who were the sole wage earners for their families and thought they would always have a secure job with us. I looked at our budget and realized, due to the prudence of my predecessors in building up some financial reserves, that we could absorb at least the initial round of budget cuts and probably more without layoffs. Working with others on my team, we developed a financial plan to weather at least the budget cuts that had already been announced and then some. I'd planned to speak at the school, to the school, just after Thanksgiving to talk through our financial plan. But somehow it didn't seem to me that facts and figures and promises from someone who had just arrived were going to be enough to cut through that mood of increasing despair, and it was despair. I felt I needed to provide not just a financial plan, but hope for the future. But I've got to tell you, I was at a loss at how to do it. The Monday after Thanksgiving, another day I remember well, was cold and blustery with snow flurries. I was scheduled to leave for work very early to complete my preparations for a school-wide meeting later that week. That morning, before leaving for early morning seminary, my son, who was then 16, put a CD in my hand and said, "Mom, I think you'll like listening to this." I put the CD in the player as I left for work that Monday morning, but I didn't really listen to it. I just drove on through those cold, dark snow flurries, and I got to tell you, I was feeling really sorry for myself. How could I be so unlucky to take this really big job at this really terrible time? How could I be so unlucky to have to deal with this very difficult situation? How could I be so inadequate, and how could, in providing the hope that I felt people were looking for? I was driving down, and why did I move to a climate that was so darn cold? I was driving through the dark and the snow. I still can tell you where the car was. I stopped at a stop sign, and this line from this CD that was playing, that I had no consciousness of, pierced through all my dark thoughts. And that line was, "There's so much to be thankful for." I thought, oh, that kind of caught my attention. I reversed to the beginning of that song, and I listened to it again and again. And I thought, well, here's the answer right here, given to me by my 16-year-old boy. This is the way to give hope, by feeling gratitude, because indeed we do have so much to be thankful for. I went to the meeting, which was 3 days hence, and I presented our financial plan. I then said what I think were the most important words I had to say. I said, I knew we all felt afraid, and that we were part of a great institution that would weather this storm, but more importantly, we were privileged to work with young people at a very important time in their lives when we could make a real and meaningful difference to their futures. We performed this very important mission by working every day with amazing colleagues. We had so much to be thankful for. I could literally feel the mood in the room lightening. And one woman who was a key school leader, who was not an emotional person, told me after that meeting, she came down and said, "Thank you so much." I had tears in my eyes thinking about all that was good in our world. And from that experience, I learned that drive is not just doing more. It's doing things differently in a way that meets the real needs of the moment and the needs of the future. So the four key leadership attributes that we've been talking about, empathy, courage, integrity, and drive, are four things that each of you can develop so that you can be a leader, someone who influences others regardless of your formal title and position. I like to think of these four attributes as four ways of seeing. Having empathy is seeing the good. Having courage is seeing the need and meeting it. Having integrity is seeing the whole, and having drive is seeing the possible. We've talked a long time about being a leader who has a positive impact on others one by one. Let's now turn briefly to the question of how can you create organizations where individuals are thriving, innovative, and bringing their very best selves to work every day. My colleague Gretchen Spreitzer at the University of Michigan has spent years studying the question of what helps people thrive at work. And by thriving, I mean being both passionate and excited about being at work, but also being willing to learn at work and using that learning to adapt to new challenges. She studied individuals who thrive at work and found that compared to those who are not thriving, people who are thriving at work have 16% better overall performance, 125% less burnout, were 32% more committed to their organization, and 46% more satisfied with their jobs. They also missed work less and were healthier on and off the job. She and her colleagues have identified four practices that help employees thrive at work, and they revolve generally around sharing information and authority and feedback. Professor Spreitzer has recently published an article in the Harvard Business Review where she talks about that. But I want to just spend a moment on the last practice, which is one that has to do with incivility in the workplace. So a lot of the practices have to do, again, as I said, with sharing information and authority. But to create a truly positive organization, you have to go beyond sharing information and authority, but you have to work on the great enemy of thriving, which is workplace incivility. Professor Spreitzer and her colleague, Professor Christine Pearson of the Thunderbird School of Global Management, have studied workplace incivility, and their research is replete with examples, such as on a speakerphone in front of my peers, my boss told me that I'd done kindergarten work. My boss saw me remove a paperclip from some documents and drop it in my wastebasket. In front of my 12 subordinates, he rebuked me for being wasteful, and he required me to retrieve it. My boss said, "If I wanted to know what you thought, I'd ask you." These are real comments from their research. Some of you may have been the target of statements such as these, and you know how they drain energy, motivation, and enthusiasm from you. If nothing like this has happened to you, I think you can imagine how you'd feel if your boss made a statement such as one of those I've just read to you. I don't think it will surprise you that Professor Spreitzer and Pearson report that employees who experienced uncivil behavior at work intentionally decreased their efforts. More than a third reported deliberately decreasing the quality of their work. Two-thirds spent time avoiding the offender, and about the same number said that their performance had declined. In my experience, many organizations have a high tolerance for organizational bullies, people who are smart and skilled, but rude and uncivil to others. This uncivil conduct is often justified by the good results that these organizational bullies ostensibly achieved. Earlier, I encouraged you, if you could only remember one thing I said, it was to see the good that others do. If you can remember two things, remember to count the cost that organizational bullies create. Count the cost in flagging spirits, reduced effort, limited creativity, unnecessary turnover, and lack of flexibility. Count the cost and do something about it. The best thing you can and should do is to consider temperament when you're hiring people. Most people who are bullies leave a trail of victims. Don't hire someone with a track record of incivility, even if they seem brilliant. Count the cost to everyone the bully comes in contact with and decline the hire. If people already in your organization are bullies, take steps today to correct their behavior. So how do you create a workplace where people are thriving, imaginative, and bring their best selves to work? By providing information and authority, and I'll let you read about that, by counting the cost of bullies. I want to just conclude by talking about how you can use the enormous power of business to make a positive difference in the world. The great German sociologist Max Weber, who lived and worked in the 1800s, noticed that large formal organizations like today's corporations are vehicles for amassing immense power. Today, the largest corporations have more power and resources than many nations and governments. And many corporations are able to use that power and those resources more effectively and more nimbly than governments. For that reason, today, most world political and corporate leaders recognize the following that I'd like you to remember. Society's greatest problems will not be solved without engaging government, civil society, and business. Whether we're talking about clean water, sustainable agriculture, affordable housing, accessible education, or reliable transportation, today, if these problems are going to be solved, business needs to be part of the solution. Paul Polman, CEO of the Anglo-Dutch firm Unilever, put it this way. This is a quote. Business cannot survive in a society that fails, so it is stupid to think that business can just be standing on the sidelines of a system that gives them life in the first place. So our commitment to a better society is not idealistic at all. All the things that we do are hardwired to our business purpose. If you look around today, you'll see many examples of business leaders like the Whole Foods that pays their workers more than they have to so they can create a thriving middle class, like Coke and Pepsi, who are creating sustainable water platforms all around the world. I could easily give you an entire forum talk on examples like these. The point of these examples is you don't have to choose between doing business and doing good. You can indeed do both at the same time. So how can you have a positive career in business or any sector of society where you decide to work? You can be relentless about three things. First, see the good in others, treating them with empathy and acting with courage and integrity always. Second, count the cost of incivility, and wherever you are, do not tolerate it. Instead, create a climate of openness by sharing information and authority. And finally, choose the best. You will have to make many choices about how to use your organization's power and resources. Using those resources to benefit your organization is fine, but using them to simultaneously benefit your organization and the greater social good is best. Wherever you are, whatever your formal role, you can choose to be a leader who makes a positive difference in the world. I urge you, be that person who will inspire others to dream more, learn more, do more, and become more. Thank you.